Welcome to the Building Stories podcast series. My name is Amy Barnes, and I'll be your host as we explore some of Ontario's built heritage. This series will include 15 podcasts in total, so if you enjoyed today's show, be sure to check out some of the others. Each podcast is going to explore a different topic related to heritage conservation in different regions of Ontario. Each one is going to be different, because the truth is, each building has a different past, and each building has a different story to tell us. So without further ado, let's get started on today's topic. Today we head to Hamilton, Ontario, which is affectionately known as Steel Town or the Hammer. For anyone who has driven into Hamilton from the Northeast, the iconic smokestacks emphasize that manufacturing is a dominant feature in Hamilton's economic history. But today, we're not going to talk about that aspect of the history. Instead, we are going to head into town and explore a building known as Lister Block. Now, before I go any further on this podcast, for the sake of transparency, I want to say right from the start that the Lister Block project was quite controversial. The range of opinions over what should happen with the building went from some wanting the building to be fully restored in its original grandeur with no additions at all, to others wanting to see it completely demolished and a new building put in its place. This story was also a very politically charged one, and there's no denying that many people did not see eye to eye. But today, with the short time I have, I'm not going to be able to get into that level of detail. I simply won't be able to acknowledge every player, every move, every plan, and every compromise that was made throughout the whole process. What I will say is, though, there are dozens of articles, blogs, agendas, and reports that are available online for those who want to know the full story. For today, I'm going to be telling the story from the perspective that it was a success. A success for the building, for local heritage, and for the city of Hamilton. So with that, on with the show. The original Lister Block was built in 1886 and named for its owner, Joseph Lister. Unfortunately, the building was lost in 1923 to the most spectacular and devastating fire the city had seen up until that point. A replacement was quickly rebuilt and opened in 1924. Architect Bernard Prock designed the six-story building in a classical Renaissance style. When it opened in 1924, it was used as retail shops and office spaces for prosperous local merchants such as tailors, lawyers, and so on. The Lister Block was a very successful building. I spoke with historian Brian Henley about some of the things the building would have seen in its earlier days.
Well, certainly the end of World War II and even a lot of the sort of major city parades and celebrations that would have involved the Hamilton City Hall and a parade along James Street would also include people in the opening the windows of the Lister Block and, if not throwing down ticker tape, at least, you know, waving handkerchiefs and that kind of stuff. The King and Queen of England were directly across the street in 1939. Grey Cup celebrations for Hamilton Tigers in front of the City Hall, again, having spillover and all of that.
Architecturally, it also has some unique features. The most well-known being the interior large arcade with marble floors and a high arch ceiling. The ceiling had skylights, which provided natural light and really emphasized the unique feel of the indoor shopping experience. The exterior bottom story housed retail shops. And of course, one of the key features of the building was the white decorative terracotta cornice. I had the chance to speak with Robert Hamilton, who served previously on LACAC and was branch president of the Hamilton Region branch of the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario at the time. Robert's passion is architecture, and he had this to say about the building.
Its use of terracotta is what's very, very interesting for me. There's really two phases of terracotta in Ontario. One is called the red period, and one is called the white period, just to denote unfinished terracotta decorative elements on a building. And then the white period, it could be polychrome, but white, it denotes a glazing. And this building has glazed white terracotta on it. And in Hamilton, there's only one other survivor, and that happens to be the Herkimer Apartments. So it, for me, that's really what's drawn my eye to it. And Hamilton has a good number of residential homes that contain the red terracotta, but we only have these two surviving examples of the white period. So for that alone, it's an unusual building. That's what drew me to it initially. the style of the building in 1923, it's bang on for what was going on. But again, there weren't that many going up in the city on this scale. It's small relative to other communities, but for this city, it was quite unusual. The building itself's reinforced concrete construction, and it went up in an extremely short period of time. People aren't really aware of its construction, and I don't think the current owners were necessarily aware of it when they were developing their original development plans for that site, because the building certainly and has stood the test of time in spite of the amount of abuse that's been heaped on it. It isn't about to go anywhere, and I think by and large the general public aren't really aware how sturdy old structures are, whether they're two-story domestic residences or something on this scale, six stories with reinforced concrete. I mean, they all have good bones, generally, that can be worked with a quality architect.
Despite having a solid foundation and good bones, if a building is not used, it's not maintained and therefore susceptible to neglect. When City Hall, which was originally located across from the Lister, moved in the 1960s, the building started a slow and steady decline. In the 1970s, there were still many tenants, however, many were not renewing their leases, and one by one, offices and stores became vacant. One longtime and well-known tenant was Ann Foster's Music Shop. She remained in that location for many, many years. Many musicians and music lovers in Hamilton will remember that store fondly. Concerns about neglect and safety were raised in 1984 when a 3-meter section of the building fell down onto the sidewalk. The building was then closed in 1991, and it received an Ontario Heritage designation in 1996. In the many years that follow, there were 3 attempts to revive it, all of which failed. With every failure, the building seemed to suffer more at the hands of vandalism, water and fire damage, and general neglect. In 1998, it was bought by LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, Local 837. However, lease agreements with the federal government crumbled, as did the building for another 9 years. In 2005, a demolition permit was brought forth to council. Eventually, a 60-day moratorium was granted. Now, I spoke with Councillor Brian McHattie, who got involved in 2003-2004 as part of the Local Heritage Committee. Here's what he had to add.
Yes, the committee was very concerned about it. So we knew that the majority of city councillors were not interested in saving the building. So that left us in a difficult position, and several of the committee members felt that the building was provincially significant beyond just the local Hamilton significance, and they began discussions with individuals at the province, the provincial government, to wonder whether there's an interest at that level.
So the committee engaged with the province by meeting with Minister Carolyn DeCoco and urging her to take action. Simultaneously, the council was beginning the demolition discussion. Following the meeting, Minister DeCoco worked with staff, engaged the Ontario Heritage Trust, and in the final hour, called the Mayor of Hamilton and made it clear that the Lister was of provincial significance and therefore a provincial matter. Councillor McHattie explained to me that once the province stepped in, the municipality was forced to take a step back. This caused a lot of tension, as some people felt that by engaging the province, the local level had lost some control. Regardless, knowing that Lister was now safe from the wrecking ball meant that negotiations about alternative options were being discussed. Eventually, an agreement between the province, the city, and current owners LIUNA was reached. This was largely because the province kicked in $7 million to get momentum going. The city then committed to purchase the building for $25 million. But at this point, many important questions still remained. And again, opinions were brought forth and passionately debated. Discussions seemed to be going in circles. I spoke with Brian Henley, who is a local historian and was involved with the project. Here's his part of the story.
LIUNA were anxious to get going with their development and were feeling that they were being pushed back by preservationists, by the Ontario Heritage Act, and all of this kind of stuff, and they were feeling aggrieved. Mr. Deani, Mayor Deani, I thought had a very good way of addressing this conflict by setting up a steering committee that had no political power at all. It was a steering group to meet and discuss and to share information and to put out people's views, have discussions, and maybe compromises might be possible. So the steering group had volunteers such as myself. It had representatives from the owners. It had representatives from, you know, formal heritage groups, in particular the Hamilton LACAC. And I can't remember the numbers, maybe 9, something like that. And we had a series of meetings.
The group met many times, and John says that he felt it was very worthwhile in 2 ways. First, in terms of educating the owners and being able to expose some of the myths regarding tearing down and building anew. You could also talk about the things that could be salvaged easily and what features were most significant. Secondly, it also gave some of the heritage preservationists a chance to hear from the owners about what they could afford to do and ultimately what they needed from the space to make it viable from a business standpoint. John says there were many tense moments where you just crossed one's fingers and hoped that the developers didn't just give up, walk away, and leave the building to crumble. Eventually, things fell into place. Questions like, what would the building look like? What would be kept and restored? And what would be removed and replaced? Were answered. These decisions were made thanks in part to Tony Butler and Julian Smith and Associate Architects in conjunction with Clinton Brown Company Architecture, who were hired to carry out the restoration process. They set about documenting all features, meticulously removing paint and glass and plaster, and then they started to bring life to salvageable features, like the marble floors, the 2 steel staircases with original oak railings, and the skylights. The exterior brick was carefully cleaned and repointed where needed, and the ever-important terracotta cornice was kept and repaired, and where there was too much damage, a precast concrete replica was used in its place. One interesting area to note was that 3 original storefronts, complete with amazing copper and bronze detailing, steel grills, and leaded transoms were uncovered. Although the building was not exactly as it originally was, the Lister block was brought back to life and once again is being currently filled with tenants. Here's Robert's thoughts on this.
And this building has been reborn and will have additions on both the north and the east sides at some point when the developer goes to phase 2, and the Lister will be an integral part of it.
I will end today with Councillor McHattie's remarks on the project.
Well, it's an overwhelming success story, no doubt. Successful in demonstrating that local citizens can play a key role in seeing the important heritage and history of a city protected and then restored. It's really a shining example of downtown restoration, rejuvenation, as it sits on James Street North, which is one of the most vibrant parts of Hamilton now.
Councillor McHattie's only regret about the whole ordeal is that the momentum from interest by local communities to get involved didn't continue on. He felt that there's no proactive movement in Hamilton, and it feels like sometimes the city just moves from crisis to crisis. Many of the others I spoke to feel the same way. He said he would love to see a master heritage plan put in place, but he acknowledges that with over 7,000 properties listed on the local registry, the task seems overwhelming. But unfortunately, that is a story for another day, as this brings us to the end of our podcast. I would like to thank Robert Hamilton, Brian Henley, and Councillor Brian McHattie for taking the time to speak with me. If you want to learn more about the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario and its involvement with the preservation and conservation of buildings all over Ontario, the ACO is celebrating its 80th anniversary by putting together a book. This book will feature 80 buildings the organization has had a hand in saving over the last 80 years. Now, the Building Stories episode you heard today is just one that will be included, but there are many more stories to discover. You can get the book starting in November 2013 by ordering it online at their website. The Building Stories podcast series could not have been made possible without our sponsors, so a big thank you to the Architectural Conservancy of Ontario, the Heritage Resource Centre at the University of Waterloo, the Centre for Community Mapping, the Computer Systems Group at the University of Waterloo, and the Government of Ontario. If you have any comments, we would love to hear from you. You can email the Building Stories team at info@buildingstories.co or send them a tweet at Building Stories, which is BLDG_stories, and of course you can find them on Facebook under the Building Stories Facebook page. These podcasts have been written, produced, and hosted by myself, Amy Barnes, and I'd like to take this last moment to thank you all for listening.